Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Mags Morrissey.
Hello and you're very welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Frances Nesbitt, and sorry about the noise there in the background. I'm from Crowan Cottages and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. We're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Mondays from 4 to 5. Now we'd love to hear from you during the show, so if you have any questions or comments on any of the topics that we cover today, you can drop us a text to 086-353-7782 or you can email kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Now, on the show today, we've an awful lot of topics to talk about today. We'll cover some food news shortly. Then we're going to talk about sourdough and sourdough September. We'll touch on some of the evening classes that are coming up in Kilkenny City and just the idea of learning something new over the winter. It's something I always like doing. In Nature Notes, we're going to be talking about the badger, and it's the start of mushroom season, so we might mention a few of those that are out and about at the moment that you might find. In the final section of the show, we'll be talking about some things to be doing in the garden and touching on green manure and how you might store some of your produce at the moment. Mags, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. Good week?
Yes, indeed. I always have to have a little think about what my week entailed, you know, the way, because so many things go on and stuff, but you only really want to hear about the foodie element.
Yes, yes.
But I did start my day today with cinnamon buns, which I have to say is the way to start a Friday, particularly after a hard week. So cinnamon buns.
I love them so
much. Well, everybody in my house was quite pleased this morning, actually, with those.
There's a really nice variation of those with a little bit of apple, which would be perfect at this time of the year.
Yeah, that's what we're actually, that's...
And do you have a recipe for that in?
I do, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, I'll just make it up. It's not as if you can just add, if you just add the apple, you just need it to be very finely chopped.
Let's tell everybody to go off and get apple. A pen now, quickly. But firstly, did you see that article? It was covered quite a lot on Facebook during the week about the... people who eat meat live longer. Did you see that?
No, I'm going to live forever.
We're more used to reading articles about, you know, the vegan lifestyle being this way healthy and the vegetarian lifestyle being that way healthy and so on. But there was an article in The Telegraph by Laura Donnelly, which their health editor, and it got an awful lot of traction, but it was covering a report out of the US, and not a trivial report, a study of 220,000 people. So that's a huge kind of sample. And it found that eating 3 portions of dairy and 1.5 portions of meat a day could cut the risk of early death by 1/4.
Hmm.
And it kind of challenges the conventional wisdom that's kind of handed out in the guidelines by, you know, our own health board or the NHS in the UK or whatever, which kind of said that you should take in about 8% of your daily recommended calorie intake from dairy or cheese or yogurt or that kind of stuff. And you should limit your red meat consumption to 2.5 ounces a day, which is a tiny amount. Like, it's a really, really small amount. That's
I've never heard of a 2.5 ounce steak.
No, it's a quarter like of a small steak, you know. So
I tend not to follow any of those guidelines, to be honest, anyway.
The wisdom that I kind of... Really, I think all things in moderation is the way I would kind of cover it. But this had a look at those 220,000 people, and the findings were presented at all kinds of conferences in the US, particularly to some cardiologists. And it was saying that the saturated fats that are contained in the meat and dairy, they seem to protect the heart. So there was a variety of illnesses that you were actually protected from if you ate meat and consumed dairy.
I think natural anything, like natural fat, tends to be good for you. Mm. But a lot of what we eat is kind of not the natural fats and stuff, and there's an awful lot of that in our processed foods and stuff. So if you're eating anything that's natural and good quality, in moderation,
yeah,
let's go for that. Study or no study,
really. And although people do rely on, you know, the kind of advice that they're given in these things, and there's people still afraid to eat eggs after the kind of salmonella scare, and there's people still think fat is bad because the sugar lobby basically won out on the advice that was given in the 70s. And so people still buy really, really lean steaks because they think fat on the steak is a bad idea. Pure nonsense, of course.
It is,
absolute nonsense. It doesn't convert to human body fat when
you
eat
it. You see in supermarkets, a lot of the minced meat is like, you know, 1% fat, 3% fat, 15% fat.
As if the low number, yes.
As if, and you should go for the low number of that. It's kind of, it's a bit sad, actually, really, that that's what we think is the right thing to do.
The truth of it, and you're hearing it here now, folks, the truth of it is that if you eat fat in your diet, a small amount of fat in your diet, you're less likely to eat carbohydrates. So it has a kind of like filling effect, and it adds flavour to your food. And most of the carbohydrates that people eat today are very lightly processed. And a substitute for the fat in your food that provides the flavour is sugar and salt. And those things can be bad in too much quantities.
Well, we need some fat. Yes. We can actually live without processed sugar. We don't need it at all. So I suppose, and we, particularly adults, don't need to eat a huge amount of carbohydrate, particularly in mid-age.
Really, yeah. So like a lot of the stuff that we kind of take for granted or advice that's been abused over the years, it really needs to be turned on its head. But how long these things perpetuate, even when they're wrong and proved to be wrong, they still perpetuate. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose people just like the sound of something or maybe and hang on to it. I don't know. But there's always a new study. There'll be another new study next year, maybe, that'll show something else. So I still think.
Yeah, don't get cynical of scientists. There's a man in America that likes to poo-poo science, and I wouldn't go along with it too much.
But proper science is good. Yeah, I have a science background, so I actually do believe in science. And particularly after my stint down in Cork last weekend at the Our Food, Our Future conference, which was. Well, there were scientists and then there were non-scientists and there were all sorts. But there were actually, I think, the best presentations of the day were by two women who were both Chagas. One of them was on fermented foods and gut health. And she did a really proper study with kind of, she'd actually used the Irish rugby team. And she wanted to see what a change in diet would do to your gut health. So she monitored the guys, all of them, and changed diets and had a look and stuff. And she had proper, like, sort of aims and results and analysis and that. And it was all very, well, very interesting and very conclusive. So basically your diet does affect your gut health, which,
yes.
Yeah, but it's scientifically proven. You know, she has papers now on that. And then there was another lady who spoke about animal welfare. And not just, you know, because it'd be nice for the animals and that, but more animal welfare in relation to the safety of our food. And that was a really interesting presentation, actually, very well made by her. She was exceptionally, I suppose I was hearing stuff that I believed anyway, but it kind of had a scientific background to it. So, you know, animals that are stressed are going to shred more E. coli when they're stressed. So an animal going into a slaughterhouse being stressed will shed an awful lot of E. coli that it won't when it's wandering around in the field. So when that E. coli then, it's very close to the food chain at that stage and that, so that can have an impact. So you want to like reduce the stress to reduce the E. coli to make our food safer. So animal welfare has a huge bearing on food safety, which is interesting, isn't it?
It really is.
It is, yeah. And there was lots of...
not something you'd consider, really.
Lots of other examples as well, in, you know, along that kind of vein and stuff. She was Laura Boyle from Chagas. And again, she had, well, she was very educated and a very nice presentation, all very together and stuff. And then we did have a Danish pig farmer who didn't quite have the, well, I felt, the science behind his findings. They were all from his farm, done by him without, I suppose. But anyway, he reckoned that... genetically modified soya and glycophosphates was what caused all problems on his farm and on a few other farms. But I don't think that's...
So a Danish pig farmer. So they'd be famous for their industrialised pig farming.
That's how he would
and
have started.
When you mentioned him, I kind of thought, this, I'm not going to like anything this guy is saying, but he was saying that GM soy caused an awful lot of problems for him.
Yeah, like fetal abnormalities and... problems after birth
and the use of glyphosate around the place. So that's Roundup that was causing problems too.
Yeah, and Roundup used on the feed that they were using.
Right.
And then when he changed to using a non-GM and, like I said, free, the problems vanished, according to him. But I think you need a bigger study. You can't just look at one farm and stuff. You need to look at, like, you know, 20,000 farms or whatever and stuff. You need a good sample.
I have read there's a bit of a movement afoot to track the amount of glyphosate that remains in the food. So, for example, your water, you'd be told if your water would be unsafe to drink if it had tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of glyphosate in it. Like, this stuff is known to be carcinogenic. Roundup, it's known to be kind of carcinogenic. And it's poison. You have to do a course in order to spray it on a farm. So they know it's harmful. And if it gets into the water, that water is deemed undrinkable. And yet, remnants of the glyphosate that's sprayed on our crops ends up in your food, in your porridge if it's non-organic, and it also ends up in your wine or in some of the other kind of foods that you consume. So there's a movement afoot to kind of like track the amounts of it, because there's amounts in your wine, for example, which would be illegal in the water, and yet we're still drinking it.
Yeah, there was a French chef then who made a presentation, and that was his thing. So, and it was all about like in wine and stuff. And there's a huge amount of pesticides and herbicides and stuff used in vineyards. I actually came away from it going, I'm only ever drinking organic wine now, because of course, like, it can't just all vanish. You know, science or no science, I know we like the science, but it has to have an effect somewhere, and it has to have an effect down the line. So, and they had some studies himself. And this other guy, Cerolini, who's a Spanish professor, studies that you can actually, you know, giving, I can't remember how many people they had and stuff, giving them like organic wine and non-organic wine and stuff, and if they can taste the glycophosphate and stuff, and they reckon they can. So that's kind of a bit scary and stuff. And they were making the point as well that wine isn't tested for glycophosphates and stuff when it's sold and stuff. So
there's... we've mentioned it on the show before, but the wine industry, it's all about kind of blending and getting a certain taste right. And on an organic farm, or traditionally, that was done by blending certain grape varietals or grapes grown in different parts of the vineyard to give you the kind of colour and body and strength that you wanted in the wine. As it becomes more industrialised, just like everything else, there are kind of shortcuts taken. And there is a book that is about the size of an old telephone directory, and it's a catalogue of additives. And you can leaf through that catalogue, and it will tell you, like, you need a bit more purple in the meniscus of your wine, you can add ingredient on page 27. You need a touch more apple on the nose of your wine, you can add this sachet to 100,000 litres.
I'll never drink again.
But it's all
it's
of that
of
can
scary,
be. Yes, it can be added. And on the bottle of wine, in the ingredient section, actually, there is no ingredients.
No, there's not.
And the alcohol lobby has been so strong over the years that you don't have to put on the bottle what's added to it. And it's a voluntary thing to say that there's sulfites in it to act as a preservative. But everything else you add, you don't have to mention. And it's the only food stuff, it's the only thing we imbibe that you don't have to be clear about all the stuff that goes into it. It's funny, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, I love my wine. I'm not trying to convince anybody not to drink it.
Just drink organic wine. I would like to know what's in it. From last weekend, that was the thing I really came away with. And to eat as much organic food as possible, not just for what you're eating, but for what it actually does to the soil and to the watercourses and everything. So it is a better way of farming. Like, there's no... We often go back to where we started and stuff, and it is a better way. There's no, you know, question about that. I suppose it's about producing the quantities that we need for our population now, but there's no like question that it's not a better way.
And for the general public, I know it would be more inconvenient for those maybe who work in the industry, and farmers are under extreme pressure, like real pressure for time, and margins are so tight, and farming organically requires more time and more effort. But if you were being paid to compensate you for that, no farmer would mind. Like, they really wouldn't if you were making more money from the farm, because they're all struggling. As farms get bigger, their incomes don't get commensurately bigger. Like, they're all still struggling, you know. And near me, there's a meadow on a hill, and that hill is kind of difficult to get in with a tractor. And even now, when I walk past it in September, there is beautiful colour through that meadow. Like, the seed heads, some flowers are still in flower. It's kind of countryside as you imagine it. It's like something from an alpinad. You know, the colours going through the grass on the hill.
Is it going to be cut? Is it mowed? They graze it.
So it's on such a steep angle that, like, I don't think you'd get a mower into it. And it's a kind of small field as well. But all around it, on the more easily managed fields, it's just a monocrop. It's mostly ryegrass, you know, and you see nothing in it except the grass and very few insects. That field alive with insects. That's the difference. You know, that's what we're looking at as we go down the kind of more monoculture kind of route. But coming up in a couple of weeks, I met Professor Ted Dynan from UCC down at the Theatre of Food in at Electric Picnic, and he's studying gut flora and its effect on its psychobiotic effect, so its effect on our mood as well as our physiology.
Our gut feeling.
Yes, our gut feeling, and how like it can contribute to depression or happiness and all of that. So Ted is going to join us on the show in a couple of weeks, so maybe we'll have a whole section on gut flora our guts.
Yeah. Well, the key to it, from this study is, and from other things I've read as well, is to eat a good variety of fresh fruit and vegetable. That's the key to it, really.
Will you give us some more reports from Cork when we come back after the break?
I can do, yeah. Yep, I'm nearly done in Cork. Okay. I wasn't there for that long.
Right.
Now, I could tell you all sorts around that, but maybe not.
Right, we'll take a break, and when we come back then we'll hear some more reports from Our Food, Our Future down in Cork, and we'll talk a little bit about Cerda. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie.
I'm Garrett Byrne from Campania Restaurant. You're listening to The Kitchen Garden on Community Radio, Kilkenny City.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the artisan food retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're very welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery. And we're live today, Friday, from 4 to 5. You can send us in any questions or comments by text to 086-353-7782 or email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie. And there's a text in from Marion there. I love fat, and why cut the skin off a pork roast? You buy it for the crackling. Well, it's absolutely true, isn't it?
I love crackling. And really, pork fat is actually used for different things. It can actually be quite good for you as well. So a little bit of pork fat, people, I suppose, look at actual pure fat and would turn that down and have something that's processed that has a pile of different types of fats in it, but you can't quite see those fats, so we maybe forget about them. So a bit of pork fat now won't do anyone any harm, where a pile of processed stuff will absolutely.
It's true, and in all of the meats
that
you buy,
in my humble opinion,
in all of the meats that you buy, a considerable amount of the flavour that you will get from that meat are in the fats that surround the meat. So if you buy a lump of steak that has absolutely no fat on it and compare it to another piece of steak that has some marbling through the steak and a little piece of fat around the side, and you cook the two of them in exactly the same way, the one with a little bit of fat is going to be more flavoursome.
Yes.
And it's no more fattening for you.
No.
It won't put weight on your belly, hips or thighs just because it has a bit of fat on. Now, crackling. I love when I'm making a pork roast and I have the crackling. Towards the end, when the pork is done, I remove the skin. I then, on the underneath of the skin, which will become the crackling, I give that a little bit of a scrape with the back of a metal spoon or with a metal spoon to take off some of the soft fat that's on that. And then I return the skin to the oven with a tray underneath it to catch any of the drips, just for a final blast. And that crisps up the crackling brilliantly. And it's not chewy then, because you've taken off the
nice
kind of fat.
Crispy.
And it's really, really crispy. Like, you could lose an eye eating that at the table.
You could crunch.
Yeah, love that.
Especially, actually, I like pork with a bit of, fennel seeds cooked with, and then, you see, your crackling has a nice flavour of that as well.
Well, with the skin, before it goes into the oven, any pork roast, I always give it a score
and then
rub stuff into it.
Yeah.
Makes a big difference, mostly to the crackling, let's face it. But fennel is a great
fennel is companion. I actually have run out of pork.
From last year?
From last year. Loads of bacon left, actually.
All right, right.
Pork. Well, you'll have to get manage that, but anyway.
You'll have to get using the bacon now, because it's not that far away. The lads will be off in a month. A month, they'll be going away.
Yeah, mine need to get a bit bigger now. They're a little smallish. But anyway.
There's huge variations in the pigs at my place this year. There's the one that used to go wandering around the place, continues to grow at a massive rate. And
Even though she stopped her wandering.
Yep, now they're getting plenty of food. But the sister is two-thirds of her size. There's massive variation.
Funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've had that in the past, but Yeah.
There is a bit of bullying going on at the food trough, but there's plenty of food for everybody still, you know.
There you go.
Yes, they're minding the pig, or the turkeys have moved in next door to them now. I'm just terrified that the turkeys will go in to visit and that'll be the end.
You don't need any more drama, really.
Because last year, my one of the pigs did develop a taste for a turkey.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. But anyway, we leave that alone for the moment. We'll talk about turkeys again. So anything else then from that? That sounds like a really interesting conference.
It was interesting.
Cork.
I think there was most people there were kind of the converted, so people like myself and stuff. So it was a nice bunch of foodies and stuff. So there was nice kind of chat at break times and that. And then there were a few people who came along for a look who did stir a bit of, well, there was a bit of... argy-bargy at the end.
Right.
But you know what? In a situation like that, you'd expect some a little bit of chat, all right, wouldn't you? If nobody had anything to say, it wouldn't have been great. But my main message from it was, we need good variety in our diet. We need good animal welfare. That's the way to go forward. And drink organic wine.
And the varieties of organic wine are like ever increasing, and the price has come down an awful lot. I remember the first bottle of organic wine I bought was like well into the 20s, and now like 10 or 12 quid.
You can buy really nice organic wine in Le Caveau or in Green Grocer. They've got a good selection, actually.
The Green Grocer have a great selection of wine, actually.
Yeah, but they have, I think it's nearly all organic wine there, actually, and some really, really nice wines.
Well, the girls have a fantastic kind of eco-conscience, so they examine every product before it goes into
the
shop.
They drink every product before they sell it.
And they have to know its provenance and stuff before they sell it. But we've said it so many times, we're spoiled with great food outlets here in Kilkenny, like Wong's and the Gourmet Store, and all of our sponsors, actually, have fantastic variety of food, artisan food retailers here in Kilkenny. Now, there was an accident in the car park, a tragedy earlier on in the car park here at Kilkenny Community Radio, Kilkenny City. A death of millions, really. Millions and millions and millions of bacteria. Tell us what happened, Mags.
I was gathering up my stuff from the car, turned around, and I had my big killing jar of starter that I was going to sit up here and we were going to watch the bubbles developing in the hour we were sitting here. And I'm not sure how, but butterfingers, it just went literally flying out of my hand and smash. So I've had that starter for, I don't know, it's nearly 3 years, actually.
Now, in fairness, although you might say you had that starter for 3 years or 30 years, it's a bit like Trigger's broom in Only Fools and Horses. Like, it's the same broom he's had for 30 years, but with 15 handles and 27 heads on it. Like,
well,
you
yes,
replenish
because it is starter. Yes, yes. Okay, it's not like, yes. But the base of it, and I got it from Joe Fitzmaurice over in Clochjordan. But anyway, but thanks to your help, I have retrieved half a mug of it.
Now, what we're looking at here is a mug that looks like it has some badly made porridge in it. So it's that kind of colour. It's... like something you'd want to bake, really. So it's just flour, water, and
just flour and
flour
water.
And water. So, and it's living.
Starter is, that's all it is. It's just flour and water, and it's allowed to ferment, and that process gives it kind of makes it a rising agent for bread. So it's been around for like centuries. We only got bread soda into this country around 1800s and stuff, and it was after the famine where there was poverty and a need for kind of more food, I suppose. So it originally came from these Native Americans would have used it in America before the Europeans even arrived. But before we had bread soda here, like we think soda bread is our kind of our national bread and our culture for donkey's years and stuff. It's not actually, it's relatively recent. Before that, we would have used some kind of a starter, or we would have used the waste from the brewing industry, which would have had yeasts in it. And that was what we would have used to make bread. Mm. So you would have obviously gotten a lot of different kind of flavours. But to make the flour and water in this cup of starter is it's just allowed ferment over time, and I got this little piece like in a jar that came from somebody else, and then I brought it home, put it into a big kiln jar, and then I added some, so I fed it with more flour and water, and then you can see it happen. I do it at classes and stuff. I'll feed it at the beginning of a class and I'll just get them to watch it, and you can see as the day goes on the bubbles starting to form. So it's just starting to ferment and grow and become active, and once it's active then you use it to bake your bread.
So it's not the flour that's growing, to be clear. The flower is the food.
Yeah.
And what's actually growing in there is bacteria from the air.
Bacteria from the air. So this starter will probably have different bacteria by the time it gets home today because it's been in here and to the car park. And everybody's starter would, if it was analysed chemically and stuff, would have a different, slightly different.
So even though you got it from Joe Fitzmaurice, after 3 years of living in Hedgehog Bakery, Hedgehog House, it's very different.
It probably has very little resemblance to, at this stage. So, and, you know, maybe in the summer and in the winter or when there's different, you know, if there's animals around or whatever, different atmosphere and that, you'll have different bacteria in it. Now, I've never analysed the bacteria. I don't really mind what bacteria is in it. They're all good bacteria, I suppose. And so you'll just use that starter. So instead of using, you know, in cakes you'd use baking powder, in bread you can use your bread soda, or you can use yeast, fresh or dried, or you can use starter. So this is the most, just flour and water, that's all it is and stuff. So I suppose it's the most natural. And because it's a long process, sourdough is a long process, everybody knows that, it breaks down a lot of the glutens. So some people who would feel they're gluten intolerant can actually eat sourdough. And it's a fermented food as well, and we're all about fermented foods at the moment.
Now, when you're baking some bread with baking soda, or even some of the dried yeasts or whatever, that's pretty much just add it, get it ready, stick it in the oven. Sourdough breads are a little more time consuming.
They're much more time consuming, yeah. Now, fresh yeast does take a few hours as well, but sourdough, if you started a loaf this evening, you wouldn't maybe bake it until tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
So you kind of, you're talking 12 hours.
Okay.
Now, so in all of that 12 hours, you're doing not very much to it. You just leave it to do its own thing. It's not, you know, if you've probably seen like dried yeast, you know, you start off with your dough and then 2 hours later, an hour and a half later, you've got something that's twice that size. You're never going to get that huge big rise with sourdough. But you get a smaller, slower rise. Which also allows the flavours to develop.
Okay, so with all of these things that we're adding to our bread, they're basically producing the crumbs, so they're producing the bubbles within the bread. A white loaf that's produced in a factory uses a chemical reaction, so it added a chemical reaction to produce like gas CO2, and the CO2 forms bubbles within the bread, and that's what gives it its texture. Yeast, it grows and consumes some of the dough, and it produces CO2 as part of that process a little bit quicker. And then sourdough, there's actually a fermentation that's going on there which produces CO2 and the bubbles.
Yeah.
But it takes longer for the population to increase.
It does. Yeah.
Right, okay.
It takes longer. But in that long process, you'll also develop flavours. So sourdough has, I actually brought you in a bit, sourdough has, you know, like white sliced pan. Doesn't really taste of anything, sure doesn't?
No, it
unless proper bread does. But there's a nice flavour in that. And there should be, sourdough should have nice big holes in that. That's the way it's supposed to be.
Now, what I'm looking at here is a slice of bread from a cross-section of a loaf that was obviously a beautiful shape. And it has a lovely crust, lovely coloured crust on it. A gorgeous crumb and bubbly kind of texture to the bread itself. One of the holes there is so big I can actually see through it to see Mags on the other side of the desk. The smell... smell is incredible. Like, it really is a strongly...
But it's not bittery sour.
No.
You know, some people are afraid of sourdough because they think it's going to taste like of something gone off, but it's not...
I never think of sour when I think of sourdough. It's funny, isn't it? It's not like, you know, lemon
no,
sour.
No, yeah,
you know.
It's not.
God, that's a lovely smell.
A starter should taste kind of... or should smell kind of like crab apples or apple-y. So it should have that kind of... fermented-y type flavour, but not an acidity. You can taste the starter.
Yeah, so the starter then, it's just the flour and water and then the bacteria and yeasts from the air and so on that are living in there. So it's the colony of them that you're tasting, really.
It is, I suppose, yeah, and the mix of those. So
Everybody's bread will be a little bit different, yeah.
And you can have different starters, obviously. You can have a white starter, a brown starter, a rye starter for different types of bread that you make.
The first thing I noticed about this bread, and I know we did a comparison a long time ago with John when we were in the studio, and we crushed up a little piece of sourdough into the smallest ball we could, and then we took the same kind of size of sliced pan and we crushed it up, and it just vanished, basically, because there was nothing in it. This is a substantial piece of bread. Like, there's weight in this slice. And when I pull a piece of the dough from the bread, like that feels like food. Like that's a substantial thing, you know, that's going to fill you. As opposed to a white, you know, piece of white pan and you crush it up and there's nothing there really.
There's,
you know,
nothing, there isn't, no. Do you know how many ingredients are in that?
Sorry, I have it in my mouth now. Did you wait until I started to eat it before you asked me that? How many ingredients are in this?
Three. Man?
Really?
Flour, water and salt. That is all you need to make a loaf of bread.
All that flavour that I have in my mouth now comes from just the flour, the
water
salt
and
the
water.
And then I suppose the living things that were in it before it went into the oven.
But if you look at a sliced pan and you look at the list of ingredients...
Keep talking now, I'm going to have
If you look
bit.
At the list of ingredients... Sorry, I didn't bring anything in to put on top of it.
It's bloody good the way it is.
If you look at the list of ingredients, like when you... They have to make the bread in a much faster process than I'm going to do it at home and stuff. So when you're doing that, you're going to compromise something else. So you've added in whatever chemicals to speed up the process, but then that's going to compromise the flavours. So you've got to add in something else to compromise that. And then you'll keep going because... once you start adding things, you'll have to add something else to try and get another balance. So there is a move in this country to bring back bakeries and to have more real bread, as we call it. Or some people will argue it should be just called bread. The rest of the stuff should be called unreal bread or something else. I'm not sure what. But
I like the way they're thinking on that.
But there's huge interest in recent times in people wanting to be able to make their own bread and people having issues with bought bread.
While you were just telling us about the ingredients in yours, I just did a quick search there for a white bread label and there's several kind of pop up here in front of me, and the ingredients label on a traditional kind of white large slice pan includes wheat flour, malted barley flour, niacin, thiamine mononitrate, riboflavin, folic acid, high fructose corn syrup, yeast, soybean oil, salt, wheat gluten, calcium propionate, which is a preservative, monoglycerides, calcium sulfate. So that's an awful
lot. That's an awful lot that you really don't need.
Like, my God. Yeah. This is flour, salt and water.
Flour, salt and water. And a bit of time and patience.
Right, I'm converted. there's another note in here, a text message in here from a Joe. I don't know whether it's Joe Fitzmaurice, but I have plenty of starter if you need a new one. That's nice.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of sharing your starter, it's Sourdough September.
Sourdough September, yes.
And what's Sourdough September all about?
Sourdough September was started in the UK by the Real Bread Group. And really it's to encourage people to bake their own bread. So bakers sign up to it and anybody who has starter offers to give away starter for free. Which is quite... Starter take... You know, you're minding it every day. I have mine sitting on the counter.
No, you don't. It's on the
car. Okay,
it's
in the Thanks for the reminder. But it's something that, you know, you mind it like a baby. I've never dropped
have
any
dropped
of the children.
Your babies?
Though.
My God.
So bakers will give you a jar of starter and you can go off and make your own. And they'll also give you, there's a handout just telling you how to look after your starter. So there's on the realbreadireland.org website, there's a list of bakeries and I'm listed on that. So I'm happy to give somebody some starter. I get calls every now and then, bizarre, from like somebody in Kildare actually a couple of weeks ago looking for starter. And he actually drove from Kildare that day.
Down to you.
To Kilkenny, picked up the starter and then phoned me about half a dozen times after that asking me questions about it.
So it's like they take home one of those little Tamagotchi toys where, you know, they're trying to keep their pet alive and you provide after-sale service.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice though. And then just like you did from Joe Fitzmaurice, a few years later, that's completely unique to them then,
that's
their starter.
And that's theirs and stuff. And, you know, people will think, I do regularly get messages, oh, you gave me starter back in March and stuff, but I think it's dead, it's done this, that and the other. And I can often actually talk them through it and we can liven it up again and get it active. So basically to bake with it, you want an active bubbly starter, which I should be demonstrating here in the jar, but you want big bubbles in it, and that's when it's
active. Well, I grab a mic and we'll go out to the car park and we'll look at it on the floor.
It'll actually be interesting to see what it's doing out there.
Okay. Now listen, we need to take a break, but you've just mentioned people coming back to you about the sourdough the starter that you give them, probably from your classes. So if we can take a break now, when we come back, can we talk a little bit about learning some new skills over the winter months?
Yep.
So we'll be back just after this. You can email the show, kitchengarden@corkc.ie.
Hello, I am John Flynn, and here's a good one. To kill off unwanted insects in the greenhouse or cold frame, bash up some laurel leaves and leave them in a bowl overnight. The damaged leaves exude prussic acid gas, which is deadly to most small insects.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're very welcome back to the last part of the Kitchen Garden Show for this week. I'm Francis Nesbitt from Crowan Cottages, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey from Hedgehog Bakery, and we're talking about the baked goods from Hedgehog Bakery. Still time to get in touch with the show if you want to send us a text message to 086-353-7782, or you can email the show at any stage during the week, kitchengarden@crkc. There's a couple of questions in there around garden stuff and storing produce, and we might talk about that in just a bit. I love that note from Canon Flynn there about the laurel leaves, and I was reminded of it because last week a friend on Twitter saw a video of Bill the goat at my place scratching his head on an English laurel or a common laurel shrub. And she sent me very kindly a private message saying, I really hope you don't mind. I didn't want to say it in public, but is that a common laurel? And if he eats that, it can be poisonous. I lost a ram eating the leaves of a common laurel.
Right.
An awful lot of people like to tell you what they know on Twitter. This was the kindest message I'd received. Now, thankfully, Bill, the goat, is a wise old goat, and he never seems to eat the laurel leaves because they are poisonous.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's a fantastic source of not just the insect killer that Canon Flynn told us about in that note, but it's a great source of cyanide.
Ah.
Yes. So if ever you're looking for a drop of cyanide, a distillation...
Well, I have a whole hedge of laurel, so...
A distillation from the leaves of laurel was a famous source back in the Victorian era, and I'm sure it probably got a mention in a Marple novel or Hercule Poirot or whatever.
Now, I just like Canon Flynn's voice, actually. Yeah, he could just say anything
fabulous.
He likes.
Absolutely. We just get him to read some stuff on the show.
Exactly. Recipe.
Yeah, you were talking to us about sourdough bread, and you give a sourdough starter to an awful lot of the people who come to do a course with you out at Hedgehog. You've a course coming up.
I have a good few courses, actually, and it's funny, the minute it hit September, there was a big increase in people interested. So I have quite a lot of courses. Most of them are actually booked out now, so which is good.
I think over the winter, it's fantastic to kind of learn a new skill. So 3 years ago, I learned about welding. 2 years ago, I did wood turning. Last year, I did wood turning again. This year, I'm going to do some audio editing, which might help the show. But it's nice to do an evening class over the winter, I think, to learn something.
And actually, probably very sociable as well. I think that's much of it. And I see people who come to the classes and stuff. Some of them really want to go home and bake straight away. Mm-hmm. Some just come for a nice day out. Mm. So there's a bit of everything. So
it might be a nice time of the year to kind of start looking for a course like that to improve your skills. So whether it's kind of garden design to get your garden organized a bit better for next year, a photography course so that you can take photographs of your food or your garden even better.
There's lots of photography classes, actually, I noticed.
And here in Kilkenny, the ETB have a reasonably good range of courses on over the winter. There's obviously the usual kind of languages and, you know, hairstyling and so on. But then there is get the most from your digital camera. And, you know, that kind of helps you record what's going on in the garden and so on. And there's that audio digital editing skills course that's on Tuesday nights. And then there's the wood turning and so on, dressmaking and all of that. And out at Crowan in October, the bank holiday weekend, we have a couple of butchery courses. And more people are interested in experiential kind of holidays and experiential trips. And it's something that Fáilte Ireland have kind of copped onto. And they're now asking people to share more of their experiences on the website to visitors. And not only Fáilte Ireland, but TripAdvisor, who are always kind of on top of these things, they want us to speak to guests about experience rather than your house has, your cottage has, or, you know, this is the size of your bed. People are sold on experiences now.
Yes, so that makes a lot of sense, actually.
And a day, you know, doing some hands-on butchery or a day making bread gives you a story that you can share with your friends.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
And a new skill.
You learn something, you enjoy it, and you tend to meet people, you know, with similar interests as well in something like that. So yes. I suppose it kind of ticks a lot of boxes, doesn't it?
Yep. Some more details about your courses are on Facebook, on the Hedgehog Bakery.
Hedgehog Bakery page. And stuff. Or give me a shout.
And Facebook is actually becoming, like, an awful lot of schools and bakeries and places are advertising on Facebook.
That's all I use Facebook for now, actually. And you can't really get rid of it because you need it for that.
Yes, yeah. But it's a good place to kind of do a search for some of these courses.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, I think we need a new medium for it. But anyway, for now, that's what you have.
So check out a course over the winter and give yourself a skill that you can then enjoy next spring or summer in the garden or in the kitchen. Now, it's probably time to... There's a question in, actually, about garlic. I've garlic hanging in my shed. How long can I leave it there for, and can I freeze it? Now, I wanted to talk a little bit today about the storage of our produce, because we've been talking about gluts all along through the summer, but now is the time to be putting some things away. So the trees are laden with apples. Not every variety is ready for harvesting now, but an awful lot of them are. Any of the apples that have hit the ground already, not suitable for long-term storage, you can kind of use them up, cut away the bad bits or any of the bruises, put them into any of your tarts or lunchboxes, or feed them to the pigs. But if you're picking the apples from the tree and your pears from the tree, best way to do it, lift the apple through 90 degrees. If it comes off in your hand, it's ready. And if it's blemish-free, then it's suitable for storing in somewhere cool and dark, not touching any other apples. So I put them in the potting shed over the winter, and they will stay there until next May. The garlic I already have hanging in the same potting shed, so I've tied it into ribbons around a central piece of plastic string so it's nice and strong, it doesn't fall, because I don't want it getting bruised. And Marion, who sent in that text message, that will hang there until next spring when the temperature rises a little and each bulb of garlic sends out one of those green shoots, like it's ready to grow itself.
What sort of temperature does it need? Is it okay in?
So it's in the potting shed over the winter, you'd kind of have an ambient temperature of, like, you know, between 5 and 10 degrees. So it's, you know, it's frost-free, but it's not warm.
Yeah.
Okay. It's as dry as you can get, like a kind of shed or anything like that. If there's any damage on any of the things that go into the shed, like the spuds or the garlic or the onions, I check all of the crops, because very quickly any blemish or rot can spread. So... with the garlic, it's very easy. You just spin the string and you'll see anything kind of discoloured. Make sure it's dry before you hang it. So I hope all of the garlic that's gone into the shed, Marion, was already dry, because if it's a bit damp, it's more prone to rot. Obviously.
So where do you leave? How do you dry it? Sorry now.
So when I take the garlic up out of the ground, that would have happened a few weeks ago, it's left lying on the soil in the sun until the soil kind of dries on it. Then as I'm picking it up from the ground, I knock off any of the excess soil, and then it goes into a basket, and the basket lives in the shed for until I'm ready, so maybe a week or two. And then when I have a bit of time and I want to tie them together, it gets another little brush. Any of the kind of dirty soil or dirty pieces of paper that are on the bulb come off. By this stage, the stalks have completely dried. You don't want those hanging up when they're wet or when there's any moisture in those, because it can provide rot. And then it's almost papery, the stalks. And then I wrap those, or I braid those around a central piece of plastic twine. And then I use plastic because it doesn't rot and it's able to support the weight of the bulbs of garlic. And so I braid them around that, and then they hang from a rafter in the potting shed where there's a good flow of kind of air around them. But there's no direct sun on them. They're well away from any kind of rodents which might go crawling on them. And they're dry. Most importantly, they're dry. And in the spring, each little one of those bulbs of garlic in the head of garlic wants to grow into a new garlic plant. Just like the spuds that you store want to grow into a new spud plant. And so in spring, they naturally just want to get growing. And so you'll see the little shoots coming out of each of the bulbs of garlic. And
Once the temperature starts to rise.
Okay. So they know winter is over, spring has arrived, they want to get growing. And they're reaching for the sun. Just like your spuds, you know, if you leave them in the press for too long, they start to spread. So they will happily keep there, Marion, all winter until next spring. But you'll have to keep an eye on them. And in the notes over the winter, every couple of weeks, when I go checking my apples or spuds, I might give it a mention here as well. With the spuds, it's very easy. They all go into a paper bag. And then every few weeks, I tip out the paper bag. And no matter how diligent I was at the previous check, I'll find one or two spuds that are just gone a bit soft, or maybe a touch of blight got into them, or something was nibbling in them that I didn't notice when it went into the bag. And any of those bad spuds go into the bin. and the rest go back into the same bag if it's still fine, or a new paper bag, a feed sack, and they'll keep all winter. And I was using spuds right the way up to the summer this year from last year.
Cool.
Yeah, it is cool. It is cool. And that's not like temperature controlled or anything. So all the spuds that you eat over the winter and over the summer, generally they come from a temperature controlled warehouse, like a huge big hangar of a place, where they're kept nice and cool and they're kept dormant. Mine are just in the potting shed in paper bags, you know, so you can store them all winter yourself. And then I'll have enough left over to go in as seeds for the following year.
My memory of spuds over winter was in a pit.
Ah, yes.
A big pit of potatoes, which would have been quite a sizable thing, yeah. Like enough potatoes for us to eat every single day for the whole winter and beyond.
And covered with soil.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what exactly it was covered with, but it was covered with something.
Yeah, they kind of look like a barrel.
Kind of straw for,
yes, straw first, straw first, and then the soil. And yeah. It was all about keeping them dark and keeping them cool.
And keeping them dry.
And the straw was there to keep them dry. But the amount of effort that was involved in that, yeah. Like a lot of these old remedies and stuff, methods were fantastic and they worked, they proved the test of time and all of that, but they required a huge amount of effort. And just like we don't store hay in ricks anymore for the same reason, it all goes into bales. I've never had a problem storing my spuds in a bag because I have somewhere dry to kind of keep them, on a concrete floor or just off the concrete floor. Whereas if you lived in a kind of mud-walled house, it might have been a problem, you know. And so you used the barrel.
I didn't live in a mud-walled house.
But traditions form. Traditions form. Yeah. And that's what
it's
people just
keep
doing.
It's just my memory, but my memory is of like somebody having to go out and to get potatoes from the pit. They would have been, I think, maybe once a week and stuff. They would have been opened and taken out or something. But it did work. Mm. It was quite a lot of work, obviously.
Huge amount of work.
Yeah.
I've never used the barrel, John Seymour mentions it in his complete guide to self-sufficiency, and it's in all of the old books on how to store your spuds. A clamp.
You don't
clamp.
See people.
No.
I haven't seen one for a long time now.
No, I don't. Mine store perfectly fine in the bags. Pears, almost ready.
I had one actually.
Yes.
Today. It was a little bit crunchy, but it was quite nice.
They don't store very long though.
I only have two trees, and so I just generally eat them. The geese will take anything that's like they can actually reach. They're quite nice though. But not the best year for pears actually. I had loads last year, like absolutely was hanging with them. This year there's not that many actually.
Yeah, it's funny. Depends on when the kind of wind and the frosts and stuff touch.
I think the drought as well didn't help actually.
I didn't have a single quince this year. A single quince on the trees. And not a great year for almonds either. There's very few almonds on the tree. Oh. Yeah. But other things then, of course, like really benefit, like so many blackcurrants, huge numbers of blackcurrants this year.
Yeah,
they loved the sunshine.
The raspberries are very good this year too, actually. I'm still picking a bowl a day.
And despite the really, really dry summer, it's looking like a really good year for mushrooms. And I've just booked another course for the winter, but I've booked a place on the mushroom hunt out at Lavistown House in October. lavistownhouse.ie, and so I'll go out with the Goodwillies, I think it's the 15th of August, and we'll head off and do some mushroom hunting there. And fantastic thing about that course is that it's not just about collecting edibles, it's about collecting whatever mushrooms you can find and identifying them and just having a chat and learning from Roger Goodwillie, who is just a brilliant man and knows so much about it. So I'll try and record something from that, but I'm really looking forward to it. But the first horse mushroom I've seen out at Cruachan was out there today while I was up with the animals. A massive, big, perfect horse mushroom. So if I cook that tonight, it'll be lovely. But if I decide I'll leave that there until tomorrow...
It'll be eaten by the slugs.
Yeah, and it'll look well past its best. They just don't keep... but there are some other things to do apart from look out for mushrooms. It's the ideal time of the year to lift and divide any of your herbaceous perennials that you might have in the garden, if you want to kind of start moving them around to different places. And one that you really kind of need to do now, I wanted to mention it early on in September, is if you want to force any hyacinth or amaryllis bulbs for Christmas, now is the time to get them planted. So hopefully they've had they've stored well in their bags in the shed, which is where I have mine, and it's time to get them into a bulb compost now. Cover the top of that compost with some grit so that the top of the bulb stays dry. It'll take them a good while to kind of get going, but once they do, then you want them in flower around about Christmas time. It's a lovely smell, I think, to have around the place. And speaking of bulbs, now is a good time to get your spring flowering bulbs into the ground. So a lot of the supermarkets and all of the garden centres have daffodils and crocus and hyacinths and so on in stock now for getting into the ground for the spring. Nothing cheerier, I think, than a good show of daffodils. And unfortunately, 2018 was a poor year for the old daffodils.
Yes, it was. Very poor, actually.
Yeah, but get them into the ground now and hopefully 2019 you'll see a lovely display. It might be a good... good time as well for you to start thinking about any fruit trees that you want or any trees that you want to get planting. So get them ordered now. A bit early maybe for the planting yet.
But yeah, if you want to do bare root, you're going to wait until November, yeah. Really.
But with the likes of Seed Savers and so on, the varieties sell out very quickly. So if there's any particular tree that you wanted to get your hands on, now's the time to start hunting it out before it becomes unavailable. And any of the biennial plants, things like wallflowers or foxgloves or violas, it's time to start planting those now. And you've another job that you wanted to do? Speaking of flowers, time to plant?
Sweet peas. Yes, they're going in now. You really need to start those September, October for next year.
Mm.
And actually, I'm going to do a class in growing cut flowers.
All right.
That's my one for the winter.
Very good. And Where are you going to do that?
Well, you have to travel for it. There's not one in Kilkenny and stuff. So, Kilroodry.
Oh, Kilroodry.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds lovely, though.
Yeah.
Nice. And is it a one-day course? Right. Okay. Well, that's a nice trip up to Kilroodry and Kilroodry House.
Yep.
Beautiful, beautiful location.
Lovely place.
And a nice skill to have as well to learn how to grow some flowers in the garden that you can kind of chop and bring into the house, bring a bit of colour.
I picked a lovely bunch actually this morning of cut flowers that had grown and stuff, and just fabulous. They're beautiful actually. Mm. So much nicer, and it's much more sustainable and all the rest. It's all just outside your door. You don't need to be buying stuff that's been shipped from Africa or
it's lovely
some
to
part
have
of
flowers
Europe,
in the
whatever,
house. It really is. Well, we've run out of time for another Kitchen Garden show for another week, and we hope you enjoyed it. And remember, you can keep in touch with us during the week on Twitter. I'm at Nesbitt F, or you can keep in touch with Mags at Mags Morrissey, or you can email the show kitchengarden@crkc.ie. And to listen back to a podcast of this or any of the other shows, you can visit thekitchengarden.ie. We'll be back on Community Radio Kilkenny City live next Friday at the same time from 4 to 5.